There we go. Okay. Very good. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahano Bhunaktu, Sahavidyan Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastuma, Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti 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 Chaitanyam Sarvagam Sarvam Sarva Bhuta Guhashayam Yat Sarva Vishayatitam Tasmai Sarva Vide Namaha. Om. Very good. Welcome to you all. Welcome also to the many students attending this class online. We continue in the middle of this huge and important chapter 18 of Upadesha Sahasri. And our topic today, let me just to introduce a series of verses. Our topic today is focused on Chidabhasa, almost always translated as reflected consciousness, which is a suitable translation, I suppose. But what is it? What does that mean? You know, for most people, that expression, reflected consciousness, is very abstract. Consciousness itself is already fairly abstract. Then reflected consciousness. Oh, thank you. Gosh, I keep forgetting to push these buttons, as it were. Good, thank you. And last week I forgot to put the slides up, and you got that also. Good. So if consciousness is abstract, then chidakasha, reflected consciousness, is abstract squared. How's that? So let's make sure. First of all, consciousness, I think for you, is not abstract because this text focuses so much on it, and I think any sincere student of Vedanta comes to understand that what consciousness is. But this idea of reflected consciousness is much more subtle. Of course, it's reflected in the mind, and as I've joked many times, it's not that the mind is a shiny object that can reflect anything. So this is a metaphor. So this is going back to one of our most important points right now. To say that consciousness is a reflection at all is a metaphor, which means it's not reflected. A metaphor is not the thing. A metaphor is a tool to describe and understand something. So consciousness doesn't get reflected at all. And just to understand why I'm being so cut and dried about that. For consciousness to be reflected, the reflecting medium would have to be as real as consciousness. Right? So if a mirror has to be as real, can you use an imaginary mirror to see yourself? The mirror has to be as real as you are. So a reflecting medium for consciousness would have to be as real as consciousness. That's problematic for at least two reasons. One is, nothing's as real as consciousness. Second, if there were a second reality, Advaita goes out the door. So I'm just making the point. Finally, speaking, consciousness is not reflected, which is why we, in prior classes, and again today, I think Shankara is going to say that reflected consciousness is false. We say that. The reflection of your face in an imaginary mirror is false. No problem. So this is our siddhanta. The word we use for our final conclusion is siddhanta. But remember, the way Advaita Vedanta works is many stepping stones, to get to that Siddhanta and this concept of reflected consciousness is an important stepping stone. So we're not just throwing it away, we're using it, but with full awareness of the fact that it's a metaphor and not the real thing. So, Chidabhasa, and we've had this discussion before, I'll keep it short. The best way to understand Chidabhasa is, so abhasa, reflection in the mind, is technically correct, but maybe confusing or misleading. How about appearance in the mind, which is literally correct? Abhasa can mean reflection. Abhasa can mean appearance, especially a false appearance. So there we go. So Chidabhasa, a more nuanced definition, is a false appearance of consciousness in the mind. And the simplest way of understanding it, which we've discussed here before, is experience. That's it. Whatever you're having now, is it pure, unqualified consciousness? No. But obviously, consciousness is not absent right now, so therefore it is conditioned consciousness, conditioned by your mind. Consciousness conditioned by your mind is what we call experience. So what you're experiencing right now is Chidabhasa. That goes back to earlier discussions on the fact that you don't experience me directly. You don't experience anything outside directly. Everything is experienced indirectly. When it finally becomes manifest in your mind, and your mind being closely associated with consciousness, there is this so-called, this is, by the way, this is starting, I don't want to get in trouble. There's another metaphor, we said, of a Chedavada. We don't want to go there right now. This is already as much as we can handle for now, so let's just stay focused on that. And I'm editing what I was about to say, so I don't want to, that even when I use the word conditioned consciousness. Although we're going to get that conditioning here. So anyway, with this introduction, I think it's a good time to pick up the thread. First of all, I will remember this time to turn on the slides for our online video viewers. By the way, for our online friends, doesn't make any difference. For our local students, they have a big screen to watch. But for those of you watching online, it's crucial, and I apologize for forgetting to get that up in last week's class. All right. We'll continue. Abhasastadabhavascha, abhasastadabhavascha, drishe simana chanyata, drishe simno. Yeah, simno, correct. Lokasya yuktita syatam, lokasya yuktita syatam, tadgrahaschatatasati, tadgrahaschatatasasi. Abhasa, tad abhavahacha, abhasa, the presence of Chidabhasa, and tad abhava, the absence of that. So Chidabhasa is present right now, waking state. Chidabhasa is present in dream state. What about in deep sleep? Tricky. A little complicated. If, and there are several ways of interpreting deep sleep, but if we say deep sleep is a condition in which the mind is in a resolved condition, an avyakta, avastha, that which is in a resolved condition can't do anything, including can't reflect consciousness, metaphorically. So therefore, consciousness is present in deep sleep. Chidabhasa, experience, is not present in deep sleep. There's a lot more we could say about it, but that's not Shankara's point here. The point is that in the third line, lokasya, for people like you and me, syatam, excuse me, syatam, these two exist. These two, excuse me. These two are recognized, the presence and absence of chitta-bhasa. Notice, not the presence and absence of consciousness. Presence and absence of chitta-bhasa, syatam. They both occur, lokasya, for people, and are recognized. Why? Drishehi simnaha. This is such an interesting expression. My translation is pretty lame because the concept is very profound, and I don't think you can express it in just a couple of words. Of course, you understand consciousness remains in the waking state, in the dream state, even in deep sleep. Consciousness remains. The reflection goes away. So obviously, if you're looking in a mirror, if the mirror goes away, do you go away? And doesn't that describe deep sleep? Mirror is your mind. Remove the mirror. This face doesn't go away. Remove the mind, consciousness doesn't go away. That is the condition of deep sleep. The way it's explained here, I don't think I've seen this anywhere. He says, drishehi simnaha, because of the boundary. Simna means edge or boundary. Simun, I should say. Sima, it becomes with the proper declension. I think also it occurs in Hindi, right? Sima, edge. But watch what Shankara means here. He means that because of the edge or boundary, so to speak, of consciousness, it is experienced. Consciousness is present, not experienced. Consciousness is present in all the three states, which means all the three states, waking, deep, and sleep, exist within the boundary of consciousness. That's literally what's being said here. But now we have to explore, what do you mean boundary of consciousness? We've had this discussion in earlier chapters. We've spent a lot of time exploring it. Consciousness has no edge, has no boundary. So what is this drishe? Drishi, by the way, means consciousness here. Drishehi simnaha, because of the boundary or edge of consciousness, which means that the three states, waking, dream, and deep sleep, exist within consciousness, no problem at all, until you try to explore the edge of consciousness. So if these three are within consciousness, what lies outside? So it's like in the universe. Everything exists within the envelope of the universe. What exists outside? People like to ask these questions. Well, the example of cosmology is not the same as this example, this topic of what exists inside consciousness is waking, dream, sleep, any experience lies within. What lies outside? Now, that very question turns out to be invalid. Because there is no inside and outside if there's no edge. If you ask what lies outside of consciousness, and consciousness is properly understood as being edgeless, boundaryless, limitless, all-pervasive, then there is no such thing as inside and outside. It's like the metaphor that Vedanta uses all the time is akasha, space. What lies inside space? Okay. What lies outside? Meaningless, right? Okay. So this is what it's, if you want to think, but Shankara does intentionally use this word sima, edge. So then the question is, what in what sense is he talking about an edge If I were to redo this translation, I would have to say that sima here means not edge or boundary. Notice I haven't even tried to do that. But properly understood, horizon. And horizon is such a wonderful example. The horizon is an edge, right? Okay, so if the horizon is an edge, go find out what's on the other side. You get it, right? As you go towards the horizon, it's constantly receding. It is an edge, but it's a unique edge. It's a constantly receding edge. And I think that was Shankara's intent in using this word sima, because consciousness has no edge. It's like the ever-expanding horizon. Okay. That's the first sentence. The second sentence here is yuktitaha, logically speaking, tadgraha cha tata sati. The tadgraha, the observer of tat, that. Not graha, yeah, observer would be fine, sakshi. The observer, the sakshi of that, what is tat? The presence and absence of the of reflected consciousness, first line. So the observer of the presence and absence of reflected consciousness, tathasati, must certainly be existing. It exists. Yuktitaha, according to logic. Now, if you wonder why is Shankara bringing in this word in yuktitaha, in the last class I mentioned that we skipped over about a dozen verses on a complicated Purvapaksha Siddhanta section on Buddhism. And we skipped over it because you have to be an expert on Buddhism before you can understand Shankara's refutation of Buddhism. But to summarize that whole thing, the Buddhists, by the way, the biggest distinction between Buddhism and Vedanta is Buddhism is limited. So let me start with Vedanta. In Vedanta, we use Shruti, Yukti, and Anubhava. Scripture, reasoning, and experience. Buddhism has one arm. One arm is not a good metaphor, is it? How many? If you had three arms, one of them would be tied behind your back. If you had three arms, one of them would be tied behind your back, and that is scripture. So Buddhism has no recourse to scripture. Therefore, Buddhism is highly, highly, highly dependent on yukti. And in those verses we skipped over, there was a lot of yukti in a Buddhist attempt to prove that what you're experiencing now is just a flow of thoughts. There is no observer. This is a very highly developed theory in Buddhism, that what you experience now is a constant flow of thoughts with no observer. According to Buddhism, the presence of the sense of being an observer is somehow an artifact, a side effect of this flow of thoughts. This is how they explain it. Of course, some of you are frowning. How can that be? Exactly. We're not talking about a side. Are you a side effect? You, the conscious, this is ultimately what Buddhism concludes. You, the conscious being, are a side effect of the flow of thoughts. That's counterintuitive. Now, counterintuitive means experiential, but then Shankara, in the verses we skipped over, used a lot of logic to examine their theory and refute it, and his refutation ends here. So he's just used some very simple logic to show that the presence and absence of experience itself is known to you. So there must be a knower, Sakshi, consciousness. Okay, that's his point. All right, excuse me. Okay, we'll continue. Now, we see a Purvapaksha, an opposing point of view, which probably is the Buddhist who just got refuted. It's like if someone slaps you in the face, you want to respond to that. So here the Buddhist has just been figuratively slapped in the face, and the Buddhist responds. Nanvevam drishi sankrantir, nanvevam drishi sankrantir, ayah pindegni vat bhavet, ayah pindet bhavet, mukha bhasavadit yetata, mukha bhasavadit yetata, adarshetan nirakritam, adarshetan nirakritam. So, nanu, but evam, thus, if you say thus, if your contention is that the three states of experience arise within consciousness, then the Buddhist contention is drishi sankrantihi. Then there is sankrantihi. Literally crossing over, and I'm not sure that's a helpful expression right here. Certainly, one thing we understand is there's a lot, yeah, crossing over in that sense. There's a crossing over, sankranti means crossing over. There's a sankranti between waking and dream, dream and sleep, sleep and waking. So take sankranti in that sense. So the sankranti, but notice he says it is drishi. Sankranti. Drishi means seer. It's a word Shankara likes to use for consciousness, as he did in the last verse. Drishehe is drishi, that drisher we saw before. So notice here, the Buddhist attributes the change, when you change from waking to dream, dream to sleep, and sleep to waking, the Buddhist attributes that not the chitta-bhasa, but the chit. That's what he's saying here. Drishihi, drishi-sankranti. There is a shift of state between these states of consciousness. There is a shift of consciousness. What a common expression in modern times, and states of consciousness. And everyone who's on a spiritual path, they talk about, oh, you have to raise the state of your consciousness. Consciousness raising is a term that was popular back in the 60s when I was starting off in all this. Where that was used most often was in the early days of the women's liberation movement. They used that term constantly in the 1960s. We have to raise the consciousness of women. That means women's consciousness is lower than men's. You get my point. And in fact, properly understood, consciousness has no states, full stop. And this is what most people don't get. When you define consciousness very carefully, it is unchanging. How can if consciousness as a fundamental reality, how can a fundamental reality change? So the metaphor, where's my pot? If clay is the fundamental reality because of which this pot exists, and if clay changes, what happens to the pot? You get the point. By definition, a fundamental reality doesn't change. Consciousness is a fundamental reality. it can't change. So if consciousness can't change, how can it go up and down? How can you raise consciousness? How can there be states of consciousness? A very common mistake is to call waking, dream, and sleep, jagrat, swapna, and sushupti, are not three states of consciousness. If you want to call them three states of reflected consciousness, congratulations, you've understood properly. If you want to call them three states of experience, that's also acceptable, absolutely acceptable. But if you call them three states of experience, you have failed to understand that consciousness is a fundamental reality, and that happens to be one of the central teachings of Vedanta. So in American English, if you say there are three states of consciousness, you've missed the boat, because this is one of the central teachings. Okay, enough said. But this is the perspective of the Buddhist. By the way, we know consciousness is a fundamental reality because shruti, yukti, anubhava, because scripture says it, and that scripture is supported by yukti, reasoning, and confirmed through experience. Buddhists have one of their three arms tied behind their back, so they have no declaration, no scriptural declaration that consciousness is a fundamental reality. So they end up dismissing the reality of consciousness, as we discussed before. So the Buddhist here says, drishi sankrantihi, consciousness is a changing thing. And then he gives a metaphor. He says, ayah pinde agnivat bhavet. Consciousness bhavet is like agnivat, is like fire, which is ayah pinde, in a lump of iron. Ayas is iron. In a lump of iron, fire is present. And that fire present in the iron gives rise to different colors. If the iron is very hot, it looks orange. If the iron is not so hot, it looks red. If the iron is not very hot at all, it looks black. By the way, these three colors are chosen very deliberately, because the orange iron represents the waking state, the red iron represents the dream state, and black iron represents the deep sleep state. So definitely the iron seems to undergo change due to agnivat, due to the presence of fire in that. But does the iron really undergo change? And here it becomes tricky, because this is a metaphor, another drishtanta. So the Buddhas here are using this drishtanta to try to support their hypothesis theory. It's an unproved hypothesis. In fact, it is a negated hypothesis, negated by Vedanta. They're trying their best to prove their hypothesis that just as fire, just as iron undergoes change due to fire, we have to maybe try to connect all this metaphor, in the same way, consciousness undergoes change due to mind. I'm going to say that again. Just as iron undergoes change due to fire, consciousness undergoes change due to mind. You get the metaphor? It's wrong, of course. Because it's not consciousness that undergoes change due to mind, but chittabhasa that undergoes change due to mind. But this is the problem of the Buddhists, since they don't accept chit, they can't differentiate between chit and chittabhasa. That differentiation goes away in Buddhism. So, but this is the Buddhist contention that just as iron undergoes change due to heat and becomes orange, red, and black, in the same way consciousness undergoes change due to the mind and becomes waking consciousness, dream consciousness, and sleep consciousness. You with me? So that is their wrong application of the metaphor, and Shankara is going to really blast them for it. Here in this verse and in the next verse also, Shankara is going to... Remember, I've given that the classical example, if you remember this from a prior class, is that the Vedantin steals... It's like you meet an opponent carrying a big stick. You're unarmed. So the metaphor, this is typical in commentaries. Vedanta steals the stick, grabs the stick of logic out of the hands of the opponent, and having snatched that stick of logic, you beat your opponent with that stick of logic. And that's what Shankara is doing here. He says, the S means Siddhanta. So Shankara replies to this contention of the Buddhists that Mukha Abhasavat Iti Etat Adarshe Tan Nirakritam. Let me unpack that for you. Mukha Abhasavat. Just like the Abhasa, the reflection of the face, in second, last line, Adarshe, in the mirror, according to the iti etat, according to the metaphor of the face in the mirror, according to the metaphor of face in the mirror, tan, which is tat, that, your contention, nirakritam, it's already been dismissed. Notice, using the metaphor of the mirror, we can easily distinguish between face and reflected face. But notice that our Buddhists are not using that metaphor. It's shifted to this other metaphor. And now the question is, so if you use the metaphor of face reflected in a mirror, very easily we can explain that consciousness does not change according to the mind. In fact, we'll do that right here. In fact, what it is if you use the metaphor that we've been using, the metaphor of reflection, we could say that your face reflected in an orange-tinted mirror, your face looks orange. Waking state, right? So in this condition, what's orange? Your reflected face looks orange, but orangeness belongs to the mirror. Waking condition belongs to the mind. It's the mind that's awake. Consciousness doesn't wake up. Well, people use that expression, right? You have to wake up your consciousness. It never goes to sleep. I don't know. This modern language is highly problematic because people just assume it's true. Anyway, so here, if the mirror is orange, your face looks orange. If your mind is awake, consciousness seems to be awake, but in fact, the awakeness is in the reflected consciousness, not consciousness as such. This is what we've been discussing for a long time now. Similarly, if the mirror is tinted red, your face looks red. But the redness belongs to the mirror. Dream state belongs to the mind. And finally, if it's tinted black, not perfectly black, it's like the kids who have their tinted car windows, like that. So black, but not completely black. So if the mirror is tinted black, your face looks black, but the blackness belongs to the mirror and not to your face. In the same way, deep sleep condition belongs to your mind and not to consciousness. So Shankara's reply is, Mr. Buddhist, you have used the wrong metaphor. Now, I suppose the Buddhist might say, no, we have to use this metaphor, and that's what Shankara is going to blast him on in the next verse. You can't just pick and choose your metaphors. You have to use metaphors that are appropriate to what you're trying to demonstrate. And that's what Shankara is going to show here in this next verse, is how you must use metaphors skillfully. And according to Shankara, the Buddhist has misapplied this metaphor. Let me explain why. Actually, Shankara explains why. Krishna yo rohita bhasam. Krishna yo rohita bhasam. Ityetadrishtamuchyate. Drishtadarshtantatulyatvam. Drishtadarshtantatulyatvam. Natu sarvatmana kvachata. Natu sarvatmana. Shankara makes 2 points here to demonstrate how the Buddhist has misapplied drishtantas. First of all, the Buddhist has introduced this new. Notice it wasn't Shankara that introduced this metaphor. The Buddhist introduced this metaphor, and Sri Krishna. That's yesterday. In the Uddhava Gita, today it's Shankaracharya. Shankaracharya says, Krishna ayas, ayas is when you break the words apart. Iron is black. What color is iron? Black. Krishna here means, oh, that's why Krishna came. Ah. But the literal meaning of Krishna, of course, is black. Okay. So Krishna ayas. Iron is black. And it rohita abhasam. There is the appearance, abhasam, the appearance of rohita, redness. So redness appears in the black iron. Iti, thus, etat, this is etat. Drishtam uchyate. This is shown by the example. By the example of this red iron, what is being shown, how black iron appears red and doesn't actually become red. Iron is Krishna. So we have this added factor of the Agni. The heat, the fire. But iron in and of itself is Krishna. So Shankara is pointing out here that the Buddhist has misapplied this particular metaphor, which is meant to talk about appearance and not transformation. Iron doesn't get transformed by the presence of heat. If iron were transformed by the Agni, when the Agni is removed, see where I'm going? It should remain red. It doesn't. It doesn't, because the swarupa, the essential nature of iron, is to be Krishna, black. So the Buddhist contention was that iron gets transformed into different states, like consciousness gets transformed into these three states, and Shankara says, you blew it, you misapplied that metaphor. And Shankara is going to make another observation. Suppose now the Buddhist starts picking apart this reflection theory. Notice I called it reflection theory. It's a metaphor. As we said, consciousness does not get reflected, full stop. This is a metaphor. So suppose the Buddhist now, having his metaphor has been picked apart. Now the Buddhist is ready to pick apart the Vedantin Drishtanta. Can you pick apart the Vedantic Drishtanta? I'm going to pause here and just see if what is your answer. Can you pick apart? Pick apart means find some weakness. Can you find any weakness in the Vedantic metaphor? We just discussed it. You know, if it were an accurate metaphor, then there has to be something out there as real as consciousness to cause this reflection. We've already admitted that the metaphor is defective. And you've heard me say every metaphor is defective. And that's what Shankara says here. So if the Buddhist now is ready to point out the defects of the Vedantic metaphor, Shankara reminds him that drishtanta tulyatvam, the similarity of the drishta means drishtanta, metaphor, and darshtanta, what is being represented by the metaphor, the similarity between metaphor and what is being represented by the metaphor, that similarity, natu sarvatmana kvachata, it can never be perfect. Sarvatmana in all regards, in all situations, nakvachat, never in any situation can you find a perfect drishtanta. So we use it as a tool. And like any tool, after you're done using the hammer, you don't carry it around with you for the rest of your life. And this is Vedanta. After using a drishtanta, we're not attached to these drishtantas. And this is something that drives people crazy. Because first we say it's a reflection, and then we say it's no, it's not. That is Vedanta. First we say it's a reflection, then we say no, it's not. So I said before, these stepping stones. Many skillful Vedantins have understood that the essence of the method of Vedanta is adhyaropa apavara. Adhyaropa, make a step. Apavara, let go of that step. And that's what we're doing. We're using this metaphor as a stepping stone. We're not attached to it, and this challenges people because it's not the usual way things work. Usually, you have a theory. Look at the counterexample in science. When Einstein developed this general theory of relativity, did that make Newton's laws unusable? I'm choosing my language very carefully here. So according to Newton, you know, gravity was this force. According to Einstein, gravity isn't a force. So, does it mean that Newton's laws are false? F equals ma, remember learning that in some class a lot of years ago. Force equals mass times acceleration. So, ever since Einstein in early 1900s, you should never use that formula, F equals ma. Wait a minute. Did you use it in school? If you had to learn physics, as I did, you used it a lot. So what Einstein did is not remove the theory, but refine the theory. F equals ma is perfectly valid as long as you're not near the speed of light. So it's very usable. How often do you travel near the speed of light? Sorry to be silly, but it makes the point. Our conventional life is lived in far away from the speed of light, so F equals ma is perfectly usable. So notice in science, you don't throw away the prior theory. Right? What did we just do with the reflection theory? We threw it away. This is so different than science. Science says F equals ma is valid as with these under these conditions. In Vedanta, we use a reflection theory and then we say it's invalid under all conditions. And that's what Shankara is saying here. He says, where am I here? Oh, here. He says, na tu sarvatmana na kvachit. Under no conditions is it valid. We throw it away. And this is why people struggle with Vedanta. It uses a methodology so different from science. Because science is this process of examining the world. Vedanta is an inward-turned examination, so completely different from science. Let's see this one more verse. Tathaiva chetana bha. Yeah, that's what we finished, right?
Yeah,
86 is finished. That's okay. So, no, we'll continue. And I'm always happy. Better you point out errors, because I make plenty. By the way, the errors I make are usually not, occasionally here. More likely they're errors in pushing buttons on all this computer stuff. Okay. Tathaiva chetana bhasam. Tathaiva chetana bhasam. Chittam chaitanyavat bhavet. Chittam chaitanyavat bhavet. Mukha bhaso yatha darsha. Mukha bhaso yatha darsha. Abhashasht. Chodito mrsha, abhashas chodita. Okay. Tata eva, in this way means properly using the metaphor of reflection. Properly using, not being attached to it. Properly, tata eva, through the proper use. By the way, notice how Sanskrit allows for such brevity. So tata eva has to be, two simple words have to really be explained. So tata eva, in this manner, having properly used the reflection metaphor, second line, chittam, the mind which is, first line, chetana abhasam, the mind which is accompanied by the reflection of consciousness. So the mind which is accompanied by the reflection of consciousness, chaitanyavat bhavet, the mind seems conscious. Vat. That vat affix in Sanskrit has two meanings, one of which means like. It seems. So because the mind is accompanied by the reflection of consciousness, it seems consciousness. By the way, can the mind not be accompanied by the reflection of consciousness? Interesting. Consciousness is a fundamental reality, all-pervasive and eternal, so the mind can never be away from consciousness. Mind is always in the presence of consciousness, means mind always has that chitta-bhasa, as long as the mind exists. As we said in deep sleep, if the mind is resolved, then a chitta-bhasa. But the point is that this reflection metaphor makes it so absolutely clear that the mind seems like an independent conscious entity due to its proximity to consciousness. Okay. And he says that this is this yata adar in the third line end. Yata adarshe, the A drops due to grammar rules. Yata adarshe, just like your face in the mirror, mukha abhasaha. Just like in the mirror, abhase, there is mukha abhasaha, there is a reflection of your face. So as long as there is a mind, whenever you see your face in the mirror, and that face is not static, right? I did that last week. It's silly, absolutely silly. So whenever you see that face in the mirror, it seems like a living thing. That's the metaphor here. Whenever mind seems like a conscious thing, it's an illusion. And that's what he says. Abhasaha choditaha Marsha. So abhasa, the reflection, choditaha, it's already been refuted and shown to be marsha, false. There is no conscious being in the mirror. The mind with reflected consciousness is not a conscious being. You are the conscious being, consciousness. So the mind is not inherently conscious, is the point Shankara wants to make here, and he's made that point very, very conclusively to show any Buddhist objections are refuted and any Vedantic lack of clarity can be handled, again, if we use these drishtantas properly. And sadly, that's where things get mucked up, as they say. So we don't want to muck it up. Muck means make it mucky. When you, at the bottom of a pond, there's muck. You stir up the muck and the water becomes opaque. That's a metaphor. So if we stir up all these different ideas, but what if, but what if, but what if, that's stirring up the muck. Instead of playing, there's an important point here. Instead of playing this but what if game, which is what the Buddhists are doing, why don't you just shut up and listen? Because Vedanta explains everything so thoroughly. So instead of being the devil's advocate, so to speak, your efforts are better spent in just really trying to understand what is Vedanta saying here. This is a good place to conclude our class. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma amritangamaya. Om shanti 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 hi. Om tat sat. All right.